Hi, Cheryl Newman joined. Is there anybody else on?
I'm on the line, Cheryl.
Dinah.
Hey, Dinah, great.
And Ann
like
here.
Troy, too.
Yeah, Ann.
And Ann Stewart. Hey, we got a quorum. Now all
Stephanie
we need to do is get...
Hendrickson?
Pardon?
No, we're not having a board meeting.
Stephanie Hendrickson's here.
Hey, Stephanie.
Hey.
Welcome.
How are you doing up there in West Virginia?
Okay. If it is drop, we'd be okay. We went from drought to lots and lots of wet.
Mm-hmm. So, are you getting to ride some? Is it?
Oh yeah, I'm now in a place with an indoor arena, but yeah, I'm riding mud and all.
Fantastic.
Takes a while to get those 20 miles in inside an indoor arena.
Well, yeah, I do a lot of lunging. Let's put it that way, pre-lunging. But no, we're doing it. I'm going to try that Biltmore 100. So,
good.
Okay.
Good.
You know what? Yeah, you know,
I'm hoping Apex will support my 71-year-old mother because that's the only crew that will come with me and stay up all night. Mostly your mother.
Well, we like your mother.
We'll make sure we get her plenty of coffee and give her a hand.
Yes.
Well, you're going to be finished by 8 p.m. anyway, right?
Oh, yeah, right. I think I'm riding a quarter horse. So
I was wondering which one of your horses you were going to ride.
It depends on the chicken chase, who comes out of that looking the best.
I hear you.
Is going to do the Biltmore.
You're only doing 50 at chicken chase, right?
I'm only doing 50. I'm doing 50 on two different horses, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, good for you.
That'll get you ready.
Yeah, so I have two, so I've got a backup. So.
Okay.
Great.
Well,
okay, we've got Stephanie. Are there any other of our...
Cindy Nelson.
Hey, Cindy.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Tom said he would not be able to join us. He wasn't sure he'd be back in time.
And I know Anna Wolf said that she had guests tonight that she was making dinner for. She lives in New Mexico, so 6 p.m. is prime dinner time for them.
Is Allison on?
Is Allison Bailey on?
Okay.
Maybe not.
Maybe we. Why don't we start since Cindy's on with Cindy's questions?
Okay.
And the first one, I'm going to let somebody else answer. Cheryl asked me to sort of lead the discussion tonight. Crupper length tension, just a rule of thumb. Dinah, can you take that one?
Well, I could. I don't have a rule of thumb.
Okay.
I do.
How about a rule of hand?
Yeah, I guess my feeling is I want it to work, so I have it tight enough that it's going to actually do something.
Okay.
But I really just really hate it when they flop around. I really find that distressing. But beyond that, I don't have one. My tendency is probably tighter than looser than most people, which means I often rip out the back of my saddle.
Okay.
So that's why I'm saying I'm maybe not the right person to be asking this question, but I think if you're really probably go from the driving thing, if you can get two fingers in it.
Okay, that's what I was using.
Flat
okay.
side.
Yep.
Flat side, not two fingers one on top of another away from the horse, but if you can get two fingers in sideways. You know what I
okay.
mean? Like if you laid your two knuckles against the horse's dock.
Right.
That way, not the other way.
Right.
Okay. That's if you really want to rule a finger, I guess that's what I would do.
Well, how often do people use them? Dinah, do you ride a crupper a lot?
A lot. Yeah, almost always.
Huh.
And Steve does a lot, too. But it depends on the horse. Down in the South, I ride in a crupper mostly because I think it cuts down on girth sores slightly.
Uh-huh.
Especially at the canter, where the saddle is being sort of thrown up on the back and, you know, forward, back, forward, back, forward, back, scrubbing over the same area. Up north, I use them because I don't care if my saddle goes off the back as much as I care if it comes up over the shoulders going down really steep hills because I think they fall down that way.
Okay. I have a horse I'm starting who is built he's still slightly downhill, and he is not really pleased with the crupper, and unfortunately the saddle is sliding forward and that makes me uncomfortable. So I think I probably had it too loose the day he kept bucking it off or off his tail. That was exciting. Luckily I was on the ground, but I think I'll use that driving rule of thumb
Yeah, and I do think that if they can buck it off their tail, it's probably too loose.
Yes, that was my... I didn't want to go too far the other way. That was my concern.
Yeah, you probably want to ground drive it, although you also may want to check your saddle fit. If it's slipping that much, you may need a different tree for the horse.
Well, actually, right now, the only thing that we're able to get to fit on him is a treeless.
Okay.
So until he finishes growing, right now, this is where we've tried numerous saddles with him. And right now, the treeless fits him is the most tolerable. And I'm just concerned when he goes downhill that it slides forward. It makes me nervous.
It's not nice. I had that happen once on a 100-mile ride to me. It's not fun.
No.
I would be a bit careful with a crupper and a treeless saddle. I think that you get all the different kinds of stresses and tolerances when you don't have bars, because you're pulling. I mean, this is just I'm shooting from the hip here because I've never used one with a.
Okay.
But here's what my thinking would be. My thinking is if you hook a crupper to the back of a saddle that has no tree, you're going to be pulling it along the spine, which is already in contact to a greater or lesser degree with the horse because it has no tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so you actually could conceivably be doing some weird kinds of spinal stresses. I don't know. What do you think, Ann?
Well, I think that, like you're saying, you can pull in all different directions. He might be pulling side to side a lot and can cause some pretty serious pain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just tighten it up, see how it goes, but really pay attention to what's happening back there.
Okay.
And certainly look for rubs and see if you get any – manipulate the tail before you ever do this and see how things feel, and then try to move it after you're done and see if you can appreciate any kind of soreness or tension in there.
Okay. Thank you.
Because if you think about it, there are all these ligaments that connect into the pelvis and sacrum that all connect back into the tail.
Right.
You could get some pretty serious low back pain moving up. So I'm worried about back pain with that as well as some tail base pain.
Okay. Well, what we've tried, I can't even tell you how many different saddles we've tried. And right now, finally, this fitter said just stay with the treeless for now.
Can you share with us the saddles that you've tried?
I've tried the closest fit was a Canavi. We've tried an Amerigo. We've tried various Kiefers, County. Wintec with adjustable gullet. The Collegiate with the adjustable gullet.
And what is your saddle fitter saying? What is it doing?
Well, her biggest concern is that his back is so short.
Oh, okay.
And that it's causing pressure. She feels that it will, on the last rib there, if the saddle's, you know, with the, I wear a 17.5-inch in a dressage or an all-purpose, and she feels that that's putting, where I'm sitting, could cause undue pressure at this time.
Okay, so you're not getting bridging and you're not getting...
Oh. No, it's a matter of his length of back, and I'm not so sure growing is going to make a difference with that. I just don't want to invest in an expensive saddle right now until we know what will fit. And I haven't been able to find a used one either. And if anybody has any suggestions for something I haven't tried, I've tried an Anki, a Duet.
The used Albion. Where do you live?
I live in Connecticut.
Okay, yeah, I don't know.
I haven't tried an Albion.
Yes, so the used Albion's work
my
well,
horse
but
has really short back, and he's slopey in his back. And we did end up with a kind of a narrow tree Amerigo.
What
but
does
it really
mean?
Depends on the tree.
What does slopey mean?
A
lot of curves?
If you were to stand behind him, he's not flat across his back. If you're standing at his tail looking towards his withers.
Mm-hmm.
Big, full shoulders.
Mm-hmm. He's
like an A-frame?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my guy's like a tabletop.
Yeah, there you go. You might try an Arabian Saddle Company saddle with a medium or a wide tree, extra wide tree even.
But we have tried that on him. That was almost a year ago. And we considered doing a custom tree with the Solstice. And at this point, I'm not going to do that yet. I'd like to be, you know, it's hard, you know, because it gets expensive by the time you ship them to you. I've had so many shipped to me, and I've gone to different places to have them fit with a variety of saddles. And after a while, it gets to be quite cost prohibitive.
Yeah, what we've typically done, particularly with our youngsters, is we go the used saddle route.
Yes.
But we try to find some tack store that
has lots
of saddles, and then we actually would sometimes have even taken the horse there.
I go up to Trumbull Mountain in Vermont has that type of situation, and I've tried them, and they haven't had anything yet that fits them either.
When you're looking through the old, you know, like eBay or wherever it is you're doing your old saddle shopping, you might think about, and this is just flashing through my mind, I used to ride in a McClellan on a that had an amazingly short back, and it is God's worst place to sit. And the other one that's similar to that is the Skyhorse. Steve is sitting in the background. I got you on speakerphone. I hope you don't mind that Steve is sitting in the background listening.
Oh, that's fine.
Anyway, the Skyhorse is a saddle we keep for emergencies. And you might find one online somewhere. They don't make them anymore. And it's it's one of the first ones with floating trees, with the floating panels. But the deal that I like about it is it's got a major curve. It's really boat-like underneath. So your last rib is not going to be a huge issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think most of those saddles that you indicated that you'd use, many of the ones that I recognized, they were all fairly long-barred saddles. And you can get a lot shorter than that, like that McClellan. And the other thing to remember is that, you know, I have a lot of horses that come to me and they start and they might be very flat-backed in the beginning. And I'll use something very short on them for just a little while and maybe some extra foam padding and, you know, just to get, and it isn't pleasant to ride on, but just to get me through for the first few months.
Okay.
But that should be developing out if his work is developing his posture well.
Okay, and that's...
You're kind of in a rock between a hard place when you're already getting a sore back with it, but the goal should be that there is no horse that's developing himself well that stays permanently so muttoned, you know, flat down.
The dressage rider I have, a young German woman, has been riding him, and she uses a French saddle, and I can't remember the name of it now. Unfortunately, it's the only one she has, and she's not willing to give it up. But that fits him fairly well.
Right.
And it has twist panels on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenge.
Does he have withers?
Not a lot of wither, no.
And how old is he?
He's just coming 5.
Okay, yeah. As John said, he'll change a lot then. I mean,
if he's being ridden well, he might find a completely different back by the time he's 6 1/2.
Okay.
Yeah, you should hope that.
I hope.
My Drubin, when I first got him, was totally round, and, you know, he changed considerably. Okay.
We have never had a horse that didn't change.
Yeah.
I mean, change so radically that we had to readjust saddles.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never had one, so there's lots of hope. He's coming 5. He's not even 5 years old. I mean, he's a little baby.
He is a baby, and he's a young 5-year-old. That's why he's not in any type of serious heavy-duty work.
I just don't want to break him before you make him.
Yeah, I think the dressage work and lots of leg yielding, all that, he'll change, and then you sort of grin and bear it. You may want to use some sort of a pad that help compensate for a while.
Right.
Okay.
Let's see, second one, now that we've got John on, we've got several people can address that, but let me start with John. The questions, in conditioning for a 100-miler, where should you be 7 weeks before the first 100, I think, is Right. Interpreting that right, correct, Cindy?
That's correct. I think about 7 weeks out from the Biltmore.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering where I should be.
I think that at this point, if you're ready for 100 7 weeks out, you should have already done some distances past 80K or 50 miles and have seen your horse's legs stay flawlessly clean.
Okay.
Without a whole lot of support, without a whole lot of treatment or icing. It just seemed like they almost didn't need anything that wasn't a hard day's work.
Okay.
And beyond that, at about 7 weeks, I should feel like I'm nearly all the way to as fit to do this cardiac develop to do the speed I intend to do.
Okay.
You've only got time to do a last few nice finishing touches in the next few weeks, but you should feel like you're 80 to 90% of the way there,
okay.
as far as your goal for speed and his athletic ability.
Okay.
So that's kind of two different aspects. You know, one, the structure is so solid that the distances you've seen at 50 mean nothing.
Okay.
His legs look beautiful afterwards.
Yes.
And 90%, you know, 80% of the way there on the cardiovascular development at this point.
Okay. All right. So as far as conditioning, as far as riding him distance, somebody mentioned 20 miles. How often would you do 20 miles a week?
At least a couple of times. That's my typical regimen. They're out to do that kind of distance about a couple of times a week.
Okay.
My
batteries might fail here soon, so I'm going to stay with you as long as I can. But
yeah, I would probably maybe a little bit different than John there, but it depends very much on where you condition.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'd probably be doing, like, I'd go over to Biltmore and maybe do 25 to 30 once a week, and then I'd do one other workout that would be considerably less. But where I condition at home is very mountainous, much more mountainous than Biltmore.
Uh-huh.
So part of it depends very much on what type of terrain. If you're, you know, conditioning on rolling or flat terrain, then you need the mileage. If you're conditioning steeply in the mountains, then the mileage is less important.
Well, I have a question along those lines then, because I'm also going to try my first 100 at the Biltmore. But I was going to do a 50 at the Chicken Chase, which is 2 weeks prior. Now I'm kind of thinking that might be too soon after a 50 to do a 100 and thinking about going over and doing Fort Valley in the week before. But, you know, I'm not planning on racing. I'm just a good, steady pace. Just I need to learn how to do 100.
You might, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I feel like the stuff that you get from the major distance, you know, big distance workouts beyond 35 or 40 miles really has to have already been well put away almost by now for the 100. Maybe in these next weeks are the last times to do that. I don't like to crowd another larger distance too close to a 100-miler.
Well, my concern is he hasn't been, I mean, he's been in training, but we haven't done a 50-mile ride since last August on him.
Yeah, but you've had him staying working along.
He's been working along. That's not a problem.
And do you expect his behavior to be okay? Is he mature enough about how he gets along?
He's done, you know, several 50s. He's okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So maybe I should do just a 30-mile warm-up at the Chicken Chase.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to take two horses because it's a long way to go to just ride one 50-mile ride
mm-hmm.
on one horse.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd take a second horse.
Chicken Chase is when?
2 weeks before, like the 18th of April.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's the week after the ride at your place.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So I was debating on whether to come to that ride and do it that weekend, but then that still puts me back-to-back rides, and I just don't like that. And plus, I sleep in the back of my car when I do that. And it could get really cold the 1st of April in Virginia.
Oh, yeah. All right. I'm standing here right now, and it's freezing. I'm at the site right now.
Yeah.
And it's just about freezing.
Oh, well, I'm in the 50s right now, but, yeah, that's just too cold. I'm sorry for me to sleep.
Yeah.
That's why I pick rides with stalls and hotels.
Yeah, you might. Well, Chicken Chase has a limited LD, right?
Yeah, it has LDs all 3 days and then 50s all 3 days.
Yeah, I think what John's saying, you might want to do the 30.
30 on him.
Rather than on the one you think you're likely to do the 100 rather than the 50 if it's his first 100.
Right.
Now, you know, a veteran horse, I would take a 50, although I'd rather it be 3 weeks away. Again, it depends on purpose. I'll actually do 100 to get ready for a top 100, but that'll be maybe 5 weeks before.
Mm-hmm.
But
that answers my questions. I was given some second thought to that.
Yeah, but I think 2 weeks before, you want to give them, John said, plenty of time to be ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I can do that.
Rest time, John, since we may lose you, let me throw this one to you first. Well, Ann, do you want to add anything on the 100-mile conditioning?
No, I think you guys about have it covered.
Okay.
I guess, you know, I just had a logistical question. Is it to think about, Stephanie, if it's worth it to you to go ride a limited distance ride or just stay home and ride?
Yeah.
And save the fuel and save the money and don't sleep in your car.
I'm not going to sleep in my car at the Chicken Chase. I've made a relationship with the neighbors who rent me a stall, and I'll stay in a hotel.
That?
Yes.
Oh.
I send them Christmas presents every year to these stalls. Are you kidding me?
Okay, that's a different story. I just thought, you know, maybe you could stay home and ride 25 or 30 miles. Or if you have other goals like training.
I want to take my young horse, to do a 50, and I need a companion horse to go with him.
Okay. All right. I just thought maybe.
So I've got to take two horses, and if he's there, I might as well ride 30 miles or 25.
Right.
If I'm going to take him. And I could take
the
other horse, but he's just a handful. But.
So the next question is rest time between hunters. How do you gauge when it is time to compete again? And when we start with John and then get Dinah's comments and Ann's, and then if there's anything to add, I'll add mine.
John, are you gone?
Did we lose John?
Maybe we did.
We may have lost him.
He froze to death.
Running out of battery. Ann, why don't you start off first? And
well, I guess then I always have to pick the question apart and say, what does compete mean and how fast? And that relates to your comment, Stag, about using some hundreds for training rides for other hundreds. So I think in general, as far as peaking goes and really being competitive, you can probably only do it maybe twice a year, depending on the speed and the terrain and all that sort of stuff. So it's multifactorial. As far as when to compete again, say you rode 100 on day one, I would think before even sitting on them again, I'd probably wait a couple of weeks. Now, everybody has a different way of doing that, and I think this is Tom's response, where he takes a lesson that next week.
Yeah.
So there's all extremes. I think that's too much. But
John, the time I asked John this question, he said he pays particular attention to the horses after he gets, you know, after they get turned out in their pasture, and he sees when do they start playing again. And if they're playing, you know, 3 or 4 days after a ride, then he might lay off of them for only 2 weeks or 3 weeks versus a month.
Right. And that's completely off of them?
Mm-hmm. He won't ride them for, the shortest he sort of sounded like he goes is 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And if
I mean, I've heard one rule of thumb is a day for every 10 miles that they went. You know, the people just make these things up, but it's just some rules of thumb to have in your mind. And that's before doing any work again.
Yeah. One thing I'd say is I think it's very horse dependent. I think what Tom was saying is basically it's not really, well, it's work in the sense you're on their back, but I think Tom and I both like to fairly soon after, and this can be a week after or a few days after, do just like an equitation evaluation of them to see whether, you know, in a 100-mile ride you've created some sightedness or other, you know, issues just because, you know, you haven't been riding perfectly or the horse hasn't been using himself perfectly. and that then gives you some guide in what you need to do in rebalancing the horse. We used to work with a major in the Argentinian cavalry, and we'd actually have him get on the horse's back, or now we'll have our riding instructor, Lisa, just say, okay, is the horse still going balanced, or did we screw anything up? But that's not really a workout. That's an evaluation.
One of the things, at least in my experience, this is Cheryl, also after rides, the lesson that you have the week after you do 100, the horse seems to get a big blast out of doing it. And I don't quite understand why, but it's sort of like mentally they're just so on top of their game and so much on a high from having done the 100 that they want to show off.
And that's again, it gets back to evaluating the horse. Rather than how frequently I start, almost start the question, how do you evaluate the horse? I'll give you two different horses I've had that have both done very well. Drubin, when he was 9 years old, actually did 900s in 1 year, and 7 first, a second, a third. So these weren't easy hundreds, although some were much easier than others. Most of those were out west where the footing was very good, which makes a terrific difference. As contrasted with, say, the Old Dominion, where you're going to twist and turn and on all the rocks, or Vermont, where you pound the hell out of the horse, or Florida, where you're in deep sand. Super, by contrast, I will at most do 200s with him, one fairly easy in a sort of a prep ride, and then a serious competition, and then he will get 2 to 3 months at least off, maybe more, because his hoof structure just won't support the same type of work that Drubin would support. And I suspect he would go sour on me. I don't know, because I've never asked him for more than
that. What do you mean by off?
Pardon?
What do you mean by off? Like, don't sit on him at all, or are you still having your lesson?
Oh, Super will get almost, he'll basically be turned out and just running around, and maybe during those couple months I might ride him 3 or 4 times in the arena, but after a major competition like the Old Dominion, he gets a major vacation. Super is a horse who does not have good hoof structure, so the farrier is always trying to rebalance him. Drubin was a compact, very sturdy horse. Dinah, you might want to. I know Steve did 900s in 1 year with Finally, and so you might want to comment on how you all did the evaluation on his readiness to keep going.
Well, I think the number one thing we look at is how do they come out of the 100. They got to come out unscathed. If they come off 100 perfect, absolutely perfect, then it's not such a question of how long do we lay them off. In a perfect world, and when they do come off in a perfect state, we would probably be on them again on Thursday, the following Thursday after a ride. And we would probably, that would be ring work, and it would be long, low, stretchy, asking the question stag, how are they feeling kind of work.
Right.
Then they would have another week off after that. And then it really just depends on the horse. We don't have any rules because every horse is different. Every horse recovers differently. If they're okay, they go back to work. Sometimes, they don't need it. If it looks like they're overtraining, then we have to back off. We got to check their appetites. You got to check their weight loss. I mean, there's a whole lot of pieces that go into the puzzle. So it sort of gets to be an instinct, but it was pretty common that we would do 6 or 7 rides with the same horse a year. That's not an unusual thing for us to do.
So it was different plans for peaking, right, and different
plans for
speed. And
we don't think in terms of peaking.
Are those 100-mile races?
Yeah.
All 100-mile races.
Yeah, but we don't think in terms of peaking the way other people do. We try to keep them at a high level all the time, and maybe make incremental, tiny improvements over time. It's not a up and down sort of thing. We're trying to always be on the staircase going upward. Now, it doesn't always work that way, and there are times, lots of times it doesn't work that way. And there are times that, you know, you go, okay, well, this horse needs rest, and so they go rest. Or this horse needs to, you know, this horse looks like he can go on. You know, there's, you know, when they come out of 100 and they go, ho-hum, then that's what we want. And it doesn't happen every day, but that's what we want. So, you know, what we, I guess the goal is to ride them within their capability and to have them come out unscathed so that they can go and do another ride. But as far as doing rides, we like to have about 6 weeks between rides. As far as actual hundreds.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay, hold on a second.
One of the things I think Dinah said that's very key there is to monitor the weight of the horse. You don't literally have to weigh them, but Cheryl's horse Strut, we always had to give more time off than Drubin because it took him more time to get his weight back. Drubin was a pig and didn't lose much weight on 100. Super, some hundreds, he's lost very little weight. Other hundreds, he's, you know, lost. You know, it's taken him a while to get back. And that's frequently a function of trailering. So you have to evaluate that. The long trailer rides can, you know, add a fair amount of stress.
Steve had one little comment, too, and it is something that we believe, is that when we take them to 100, we want them 150 miles fit. But we only ask them to do 100.
Yeah.
So really, we're looking for a horse. We're looking for that. I mean, to me, the most exciting thing is when I finish a 100-mile ride and the horse is going, okay, so what's next? You know, I mean, I'm talking about that night. They're going, okay, so we have another loop to do? Oh, good. You know, I'm fine with that. That's what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for the horse that I've used him up.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Dinah's. You know, if you can observe the horse during the night and the next day, that's a great clue. Again, I'm probably talking too much about one horse, but Drubin, when he did his first 100 at Vermont, you know, and I was paranoid because I was asking this young horse to do so much, and I kept getting up every hour to check on the horse, and most of the horses were down, you know, sleeping, napping, and Drubin was saying, okay, what do we do next, you know? And that's sort of what you're looking for, as opposed to the horse pinning his ears and saying, don't get near me.
Well, and you see that in the BCs at the big international competitions. You see the horses that are winning the races and winning BCs. We're getting good scores, and they look like they've almost done nothing.
Yeah. The other thing I would check is when you do that first or second workout a couple weeks later, you know, really look at your recoveries. You know, do a CRI at the end of that workout, et cetera, and watch your heart rate during the workout and see is the horse, you know, saying, okay, you know, I've got plenty of reserve, or is the horse saying, I'm really sort of not in that good shape, in which case you just need to back off.
I have a different perspective because I'm a much better veterinarian than I am rider. So I like to look at the horses on the ground, and I can see how they're responding with groundwork and also with hands-on to get to know every single inch of your horse and be able to run your hands over and remember if there was a knot there or remember if there was a tight place in that muscle so that you can feel everything and let that speak for the horse. So you can tell some things under saddle, and probably most of you better than I can, but I'm better off on the ground.
Well, I think that you also bring up Dinah's boring speech about keeping records.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You got to keep records because you're going to lie to yourself.
Yeah, that's very true.
What type of records are you specifically talking about? About, you know, they feel off in the right front when you're riding, or...
Okay, well, every day we keep track of how many miles we've ridden, you know,
right.
What we did.
Right.
Did we do ring work? Did we do trail work? You know, and we pretty much know where we are, so, you know, we don't have to put down hills, you know,
right.
In the mountains. But
right.
We, you know, if something unusual happens, that gets written down, like coughed, limped, fell down, you know, that kind of thing.
Right front shoe bent when you returned.
Yeah. Well, and maybe not. I mean, if it seems minor, you know, I mean, it depends. I mean, if it seems like something important, you know, we try to track it. And then we track rides, of course,
mm-hmm.
but not as well as actually we should, because we keep fewer records on rides than we keep on anything. We throw our papers away immediately, which is always a problem. But, you know, it would be good to say, you know, 1 to 10 on the ride. You don't have to spend a lot of time on it. 1 to 10 on the ride. How'd the horse do? And you do it immediately before you, you know, that fuzzy glow comes over you and, you know, suddenly you're admiring your you know, your BC or your top 10 rather than remembering that the horse really felt like garbage for the last two loops. And then also, I personally really think cross-training is important. So we don't do the kinds of mileage that, say, John Crandall does, but we do an awful lot of cross-training, and we try to actually ask ourselves the question, what stresses are we looking for? I mean, what does this particular horse need to get better? Does he need fast work? Does he need dressage work? Does he need to be in the ocean? Does he need to climb a mountain? Does he need, you know, all these questions? Because, I mean, you know, we all know there's horses that are better at different things. There's flat horses, there's hill horses, there's, you know, horses that can't get out of their own way, you know. So I ask those questions, and I try to keep some rec. And so in my head, because we've been doing it so long, I keep some of that program stuff in my head, even though I should write it down. But I would write down, here's my program. I'm going to a hill ride. My horse is a good hill horse, but he's not very fast. So I really probably need to work more on speed. Or I'm going to a flat ride, and my horse is really lousy in the heat. What can I do about improving his heat tolerance? All that kind of thing.
Okay.
And also on your records, from my perspective, lumps and bumps.
Lumps and bumps. Absolutely lumps.
Yeah, this thing filled... You remember the blah, blah, blah from the lecture I did? You know, you don't have to know necessarily what it is. It's better if you can learn some anatomical terms, but if you can at least remember where it is and what it, you feel like and what it feels like now, and write some description, and then you'll know if it changes for the better or for the worse.
Okay.
Because I see problems in legs, and I say, was here before, and I had one past weekend in Florida, and the person had no idea. And I think that was the source of a lameness, but from a monitoring perspective, you know, they're just going to go stare at this lump every day. And, you know, maybe it'll change and maybe it won't. But for me, I didn't know if it was new or not.
Okay.
We've, I think Dinah started to move us into the next question, which is how do you condition for various terrain when you live in an area that's unlike where you hope to compete? So... let me just give a couple thoughts, and I'll turn it over to Dinah and Cheryl if she wants to chime in, and Ann. One thought is be creative. I'll give you a couple examples. I mean, one, we don't have sand, but what we do is we actually have a sand arena, and we do all our equitation work in a sand arena. So, you know, looking for something like that. One example of creativity and conditioning for heat and humidity was Heather Reynolds in getting ready for the 2001 Pan Am, because they lived in California. They actually were conditioning the horse with a blanket galloping up mountain. Now, you've got to be very careful with that because you don't want to overheat stress the horse. But, you know, that's, again, an example of being creative there. But, Dinah, why don't I let you address the question of conditioning for various terrain that might be different from where you hope to compete.
Well, it would help me to have a specific scenario.
Okay, well, Cindy asked the question. Cindy, do you want to be more specific there?
Well, I live in Connecticut. And for those of you that have had the misfortune of competing in Connecticut, know we mostly have a lot of rock.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm very confident, and this horse has learned confidence because he came from the south and didn't know what a rock really was. And so I'm concerned about, say going to New Jersey, you know, and the sand is an issue. You know, doing a 50 in New Jersey, and I think that the sand arenas, those are, I do have access to that, and I can probably use that more. But like if I go up to Vermont, like I try to compete up there at least once a year, Dinah. What can I do down here where it's essentially flat to condition for your type of terrain up in Vermont?
Well, okay. Well, one of the things I would do is put Cavalettis up in your sand arena.
Okay.
And I'd start trotting those Cavalettis.
Okay.
Anna,
can you tell me how to space the Cavalettis?
Yeah, roughly five steps of a sort of a girl step, you know, head, nose to tail apart.
Okay.
It's 4.5 feet to 4.5 to 5 feet. It depends a little bit on heel to toe. Yeah, heel to toe, Steve's saying. Yeah, it depends on the size of your foot, but if you're, you know, sort of a normal woman-sized foot, it's about five heel to toes apart.
Okay.
At the trot. And, of course, farther apart for the canter, if you get into that. That's one thing I do. Another thing I do is if you do jump, I would do a lot of jumping, trying to not have the horse plow on its front end, of course, small jumps, but things that make them sit back on their butts. And I would really put the dressage work to them.
Okay.
You know, cross-training. How far are you from the ocean?
Only 8 miles, actually.
Can you get in the, are you allowed to ride on the beach?
Yeah, if I go to Stonington, I can get in the beach, yep.
Well, then take them in the water and work them through the water.
Okay.
Right up over.
The resistance of the water?
Yeah, right up over his knees, boy. I'll tell you, you can really put some work on him that way. And it's
okay.
Pretty non-damaging, in my opinion. Anne may have some major differences on that. I don't know what the...
No, there could be soft tissue stress, but that you have to create resistance somehow. And one way to do that is by adding degrees of elevation on your mountain or your treadmill. You know, up in Canada, they were riding through deep snow, which hadn't crossed my mind.
Oh, snow is great, yeah.
Yeah.
We use snow for sand training. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
But it would work for hills, too. Basically, if you think about, I sound like a broken record, but if you think about getting your horse 150 miles fit for a 100-mile ride, you're going to be fit enough to do Vermont.
That's true. Okay.
So, I mean, you know, but you have to really put your head in that frame of mind, and then, you know, it's just not going to be a problem.
Okay.
And a million transitions. They need to be able to use the rear end.
Absolutely.
Going uphill and downhill.
Fabulous. Transitions are fabulous, and they also get your horse off the front end. Now, the big deal is you may have to go someplace where you can practice some downhill trotting.
Okay.
Do it slow, 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 slow. Do it so you're trotting downhill slower than you're walking. Does that make sense? Does that make sense to you? You do some dressage?
Yes.
Okay, so you understand what I'm talking about. You're in such a collected, not a pullback, crunchy trot, but so slow that a horse could walk beside you is your goal. You're not probably going to get there, but work for that so that they're really learning to sit down and hold back. If your horse drove, driving is fabulous to build up a hind end.
Okay. He doesn't.
Especially downhill. But you don't have a downhill. So that's so if your horse doesn't drive, I would do a million transitions. And I think I would probably ship someplace where you could do some hills.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm only, you know, an hour and a half, really. Well, 2 hours from the Vermont line, and I can do Northfield Mountain. That's about 2 hours.
Yeah, and, you know, just start by jogging it, that they learn the balance of going up and down hills, especially downhills. You know, I mean, I think the downhills are the hardest things. And you said your horse was from the south?
Yeah, he came from North Carolina, actually.
Oh, well, then he's had maybe some hills in his life.
Oh, no, he's had hills. I mean, I just, you know, in order to, I guess I wonder what the memory is.
It's better than you'd think.
Yeah, okay.
It's better than you think. I truly believe once their brains are solid, it's almost impossible to teach them to not stumble over rocks. So if you're from Florida, I've tried all kinds of things, cement blocks, tires, and they just trip over every single one. It's amazing to me. But hills you can teach them. So.
Yeah.
And remember to back up some.
Yeah,
in your positions.
Backing up is fabulous. You know, anything that makes them sit down.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that I'm very big on is lateral work, although, I mean, given your horse trains and rocks, he's probably already can handle a lot of the uneven footing and all that. But having the lateral strength means they're less likely to get injuries from, you know, side hill or uneven terrain or what have you.
And the other nice thing about laterals is if you're coming into a bunch of knee knocker trees, your horse may have the prayer of getting away from it.
That's called rider preservation.
Yes.
How old is this horse again?
This horse is 13.
Oh, okay.
He's been around the block.
Okay. Because I've got a younger horse that I didn't start trotting down hills until he was six. I just, actually 6 and a half before I let him trot down a hill. I was just way too protective. Well, not way too, but I protect his withers as long as.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't think there's anything more damaging than trotting downhill if it's done wrong.
Yeah,
I just didn't allow it. In fact, for the longest time, I would work him down hills maybe the first half of a ride, and then I would get off and lead him down the rest of the hills. I was not going to trash his front end.
Well, up here where I live, where Troy's been training, we'll ride up and get off, and we'll run down just to save the horse's legs. And for Leanne, I'm always yelling at her, baby legs, baby legs, when we start down the hill. But, you know, you have to do that.
Yeah.
The one thing I would thing on that, well, one general rule of thumb, I always train slower downhill than I actually do in a competition, although be careful in competition, but I will actually, but I'll train faster uphill in training, then I'll go uphill on a competition. If you're running on foot, make sure they're trained that they're going beside you, assuming the trail allows you to go side.
We're on the road. We're on the Forest Service road.
And make sure that they're in a good frame. What you don't want is to get in front of them and get them strung out because, you know, your lead rope is pulling them, so...
You're assuming I can run fast, Dak.
So, I mean, you know, so I think it's a good idea, you know, if you've got a crop, you know, to be tapping them on the chest or whatever just to keep them, you know, so that they are going downhill very balanced, et cetera. Jeannie Waldron will yell at me for ever going downhill on foot in a ride because she says the horse won't balance himself. And my reply is, well, I've trained him to do that in training. And
we hope.
Yeah,
and I won't do that in a ride because, my God, I'm already losing.
I don't get off in a ride. That's what the horse is for. I'm sorry.
Well, okay,
right?
you bring up a really important point. I just heard you do not get off in a ride.
I do not get off on a ride.
Yet you telling me you're training by getting off.
No. I did up until he was about 6 and a half. He's coming on to 7 now.
Okay.
No. We would walk down all the hills.
Okay.
No. I've been very, very protective of this colt.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that, you know, train the way you're going to ride it.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Now I trot him down the hills when, you know.
Though I do agree with Dag, you know, I really like to have these horses so that they can sit down those hills.
Mm-hmm.
Just sit there and it's just, you feel like the front end is as light as a feather.
Well, that's my advantage here is I have nothing but mud, so sitting down basically is the only option.
And you know what, mud is a great way to cross train as long as you don't overuse it or take a bad step.
Right. I mean, the hills I have, a lot of them are almost straight down, and, you know, sitting down and scooting on your hind end and working your hind end is the only way to get down them.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about Connecticut, too, is there are places in Connecticut that have tons of mud in my country. So that's another way, you know, that sucky stuff is another way to cross train, but you have to be careful. Just have to be very, very careful with it.
I must admit, I did train my horse to expect me to get off down.
Yes, you did.
He would do a half halt, you know, or a halt at the beginning of a long downhill and say, are you going to get your ass out of the saddle or not? So you do have to be.
And we're talking about miles of hard Forest Service road, like the Vermont roads.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to trot my horse at this point in his training down that long of a hill. No, I will later, but right now I just think it's too much.
Yeah. Ann, I think you've got the next question. It's thoughts about Cossequin ASU in conjunction with Legend and Adequin.
Well, first of all, I didn't have time to look it up, but the ASU has MSM in it, and that's prohibited. So don't use the ASU. If you're going to buy Cossequin, just use the straight stuff.
Well, that's what I have been using is the Cossequin straight. I'm just wondering, is it beneficial when you're already, you know, doing the regime of Adequan and then the pre-ride regime of the Legend?
I mean, it's so debatable. And you know, they'll do a giant study and find that it doesn't work at all. It doesn't make any difference at all. And then you see other studies that say, you know, there is benefit. I have taken the human product. I think it worked. I don't know if it was placebo effect or time to get better. But the thing about the oral products is they have to be eaten, they have to be digested, they have to be absorbed into the bloodstream, they have to go through the liver, they have to go back into the bloodstream, and then they have to get to the outside of the joint, and then they have to get through the synovial membrane and then into the joint, or through the circulation underneath the cartilage in the bone and then up into the cartilage. And you can't find too many people in the scientific community that will tell you that that is possible with the oral supplements.
Yeah, we still buy it and use it.
Yeah, and I've sold it and I've taken it, and I'm not 100% confident it's working, but I don't think it's hurting a darn thing. But I think if you're going to pick something to go with, I'd go with the injectables.
Yeah.
You're skipping the major step of digestion, and you're going right into the bloodstream and then to the joints.
Well, that answers my question.
Yeah.
Protocol of starting that in.
Huh?
I'm sorry. What is the protocol for starting it? Do you recommend that the, you know, 4 days or...
Of Adequan?
Yeah. I mean, how do you...
Yeah.
What is your recommended? I mean, there's so many different...
You know, I compromised and tried to save people money a few years ago and went with the once a week for 4 weeks plan as a compromise economic way to start the Adequan series. And now I'm back to using the label dose of every 4 days for 7 treatments, and then monthly maintenance maybe every other month. But they did do a good study on Adequan that showed that it did make a difference if you used it every 4 days rather than once a week for your loading dose.
Okay.
As compared to Legend, I mean, I know they're for two different things, but...
Well, not very different things, though.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only one little piece of the molecule away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the Legend is closer to the molecules that are actually in the synovial membrane and the synovial fluid. So Legend is one step closer. Drawback is it's an IV injection that if you're not confident doing, your vet needs to do. So the expense really goes up there.
Yeah, that's what I'm using right now is the Legend. But...
Yeah. I guess for maintenance, I think Adequan is fine.
Okay.
Let's say you didn't start with the injectable Adequan 4 days apart. You did start with them 7 days apart for the month, and you're into year 5. Does it matter?
You're fine at this point. But if you were looking at a ride season coming up and you wanted to go ahead and get started, you know, now the science has evolved, and it does look like the 7 treatments in the first month is better.
Mm-hmm.
And what
I wouldn't go back and start over.
Thank you.
Is Willie getting the Adequan or is that what he's getting?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
And then, you know, the team horses, we had them on Adequan, and then right before an event, give them a Legend injection. And a lot of people do that anyway that are going around bombing around 100 miles. Give them a Legend and an Adequan right before, 24 to 48 hours before a competition. Hmm. Start spending a lot of money that way, but we're spending a lot of money anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Let's see. 6, I'll take a cut at that, and then others can add on. How to keep a good connection with your heart monitor, especially the girth electrode. I think the first thing is you need an adequately tight girth. Cheryl will say that I'm guilty of not always doing that, and I say Cheryl over-tightens. But anyway, I found what I really like is a girth that has elasticity on both sides and not loose, but, you know, but
he likes it loose. Trust
no,
me.
No, I meant the elasticity is not a really, you know, it's a stiff elasticity, but you know, we use the what is it, the Wintec?
We use Wintec girths.
Wintec girths that have elasticity on both sides.
They're
actually
all the way through elastic.
Yeah, but I think something like that helps a lot on the girth one. And under saddle, I tend to try to get it right under essentially the bars of the stirrup, and it tends to work fairly well there. Other folks have comments there.
Has anybody seen the new pulse monitors?
Pardon?
The new pulse? Have you seen the new pulse monitors?
No. How do they work?
I think Anne saw them. Yes, we were talking about them the other
day. Yeah.
They're a straight belly band of very thin material with the electrodes built into the belly band, and they sit right behind the girth.
Do you know how well they shed heat? And
they're so tiny. I don't think it's like a big deal. I mean, they're I'm bad at measurements, but I'm thinking
probably an inch and a half wide.
Yeah, tops. I mean, they're really pretty narrow. And I just, you know, I think that it's not going to be, you know, when you're talking about the mass of the horse, I think probably not a big deal. They're quite silky, the material, and the monitors themselves are indistinguishable from the belly band. And, you know, I know we all have princesses and the peas, so I haven't really, I can't say I've tried it. I have one sitting in my car. but if, as I try it, I'll get back to you.
Who makes that?
A Polar.
Polar, okay.
They're the new wireless transmitter, whatchamacallit, which has pretty neat software, it looks like, for monitoring your training protocols. You know, the other thing is you're not real stuck on where those leads go. You can put them in different configurations and probably get a good reading, and you could play around with that. Some people don't even put them very low down on the girth at all, as long as you maybe even put one on either side of the saddle. And some people get a reading that way.
I tried that.
Did you get anything?
Yeah, actually, I've been playing around with it. I mean, I've had it sitting here for years, and I use it every once in a while. And it was just a matter really of fine-tuning it, I think. You know, keep playing with it. And I did try it on opposite sides with good results. But my best result was using an excessive amount of electrode gel. That's really what solved my problem.
Because your problem isn't that your lead is coming out and flapping around and your pulse is insane.
Not with this setup, not with this horse, this girth setup. It was actually a previous horse that I never could get it to sit right.
Won't
but
be.
On this horse, it was a matter of really getting a good connection.
Huh. And are you clipping an area and using goo, or are you just waiting for the sweat to actually?
No, well, I was always using the gel, but I don't think I was ever using enough. And so now I just, like, quadrupled the amount where it's running down everything. But, you know, I had a long ride, 20-mile ride yesterday, and I never lost connection once.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of solved that one. And my neighbor uses the new Polar monitor with the belly band, and it's worked very well. It's a very nice setup.
And no rubs?
No rubs. I was concerned about that, and this is a big hunkin' quarter horse, actually, cross, and he is kind of like a princess and a pea, and he's done very well with it. It's been quite, I was quite impressed, because I didn't think it would work, but it seems to be working well for her.
Okay. Let's see then.
I just have one final comment on pulse monitors. If I have a horse that really is a problem with having anything up near his you know withers, high back, anything under the saddle, what I do is I have my my upper lead, and I tuck it in. Actually, I wrap it around my sissy strap,
Mm-hmm.
Carrying strap on the, I have a carrying strap on the front of my saddle, and I wrap it around that, and if I want to know what the pulse is, I simply just shove it under the saddle for a minute, pull it out, and then wrap it again. So,
you
know, that's pathetic, but I have horses that, you know, you take out the electrode, and you've got a perfectly shaped wire mark from this wire that's, you know, so tiny you can barely see it, you know, and they still have a line. So that's what I do when I'm really got a bad one. So.
Okay, good. Let's see. The next suggestions for riding at night. How do you get off the trail? How do you not get off the trail or off the edge? I think the most important point I would make is the horse will keep you on a trail and on good footing. Now, horses see very well at night. They're very sensible at night as long as you're not doing something really silly. So the challenge is really keeping the horse on the correct trail.
Okay.
And some of the horses have remarkable homing instincts, and they will choose the trail that they think will get them home fastest, which may not be the one the ride manager thinks you should be on. So one is to have faith in your horse, you know, practice riding at night. And the other thing that I still have mixed feelings about, but we tend to do now, is we will put a couple glow bars on the
breast collar.
And that will give you just enough light and the horse enough light without messing up their night vision. I don't like headlamps or bright light. That just sort of messes up the horse's vision and, for me, destroys part of the fun of riding at night. Dinah, Ann, or others want to comment?
I think if you can keep the glow sticks somehow shadowed from the horse's vision, so they have to be really, really centered. Like, if you put them all up the side, and you guys have seen this, like, you'll be walking along or whatever you're doing at night, and if there's enough light to mess you up, it's a problem. But if there's a little bit of light, you're okay. And for me, if the glow stick gets in my field of vision, I'm fairly blinded. And I think that's got to be true for the horse. And a lot of their vision comes from below. If you ever look at how they pick their head up when they're trying to focus on something, they throw their head up and back. And that has to do with the shape of their retina. So visual stimuli coming from below is really important to them. So the glow sticks on the collar I would keep very, very centered so that the bottom of their head can actually shade their eyes a bit. So I wouldn't put anything where it can bother their field of view. And I would stick to the diffuse light. And then, surprisingly, Christoph said everybody in Australia had a halogen headlight on their horse. And it was kind of insane when they rode that quilty ride.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know if that's just cultural or they know something we don't know, but I think everybody would be blind in that situation. So diffuse light close to the center. If you're going to wear a headlamp, keep your head still. And you can post without moving your head. But just do it. Do your lighting thoughtfully.
Yeah, And we always carry a couple of small flashlights in our fanny pack or someplace where you can get to them quickly, because what you do have to, you know, be aware of is that you are staying on trail. If it's not glow stick frequently and you get any sense you may not be on trail, then it's time to stop and pull out your flashlight and see if your horse is
led you astray.
But my issue has been more making sure I'm on the right trail than the horse having any trouble at night. I really don't remember our horses having trouble at night.
Couple things from down here in the south. One is, don't ride at night.
Okay.
Go really fast. Don't have to. That's one possibility. I'm just kidding you. The other is Steve rarely rides with any light, and that works pretty well except when he gets lost. and then it doesn't work well at all. So make sure that you have fresh I think fresh batteries is really important. I know that sounds retarded, but it really is important. And a backup flashlight, like Stag said. The other thing is that I just wanted to bring up into this mix is some people get sick at night because they get this swirly, whirly thing going.
Yeah.
And it's not a joke. I mean, you can get really disoriented and really sick. So you probably need to know that before your first time riding at night if you're going to get sick. And I agree with Anne. I don't use a breastplate, but I have one set up that actually has its light set down below the collar part. It's actually almost between the horse's front legs.
Okay.
And pointing downward. And it has a switch on it, so I can reach down and turn it off. So it's just one of those fluorescent jobs, you know, a little fluorescent light that they use in a tent or something. It's not terribly bright. And I can actually reach down off of him and just flick it off when it's irritating, or if I'm not in front. We make a deal that only the front horse has a light.
Yeah, only the front horse should. And I have ridden with one of the old Petzl headlamps. It's got a bigger window on it, and they are better than the newfangled LED ones. They actually project a more diffuse light farther ahead, and that helps if you do get the motion sickness and the whirlies at night. You can keep your head still as you're posting and look maybe, I don't know what, 30 feet ahead of the horse and kind of focus with soft eyes that far ahead with your head still, and it actually gives you something to focus on ahead, and you don't get as sick.
I guess I know.
I get sick.
Sick at night, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
sick at night, Ann?
One of the key points is Ann said, look down the trail. Don't look at the ground right below you. Let the horse worry about the footing. You don't need to.
But don't squint and crane your neck and really be looking down the trail, just like the horse is doing. Just soft eyes to take in what you can, and you're getting a lot of information with a little bit of light.
And frankly, we tend to trot and canter at night. I mean, we don't do this walking thing.
Yeah, that's the death march. Don't do that.
Yeah, that's important. Whatever comfortable gait, obviously you don't want to be going at a roaring trot over nasty terrain, but otherwise, you know, don't tear, as Matthew McKay Smith would say, never hurry, never tarry. Don't tarry at night. Just keep a nice steady trot. Or if the footing's good enough, nice easy canter. And night riding's cool. Horse quencher, is it as good as they advertise? And my answer is I have no idea.
I went on the website and the ad doesn't say what it is.
Is it,
no, I don't know what it is.
Well, it says that it has barley, 18 to 22% salt, oats, molasses, corn, beet pulp, soybean oil, apple nectar.
I couldn't find that on the website.
Oh, well, I have a sample in my hand.
Oh, okay.
And,
way ahead of me.
And so, I mean, I haven't used it, and I noticed that they're now a platinum sponsor of AERC, and I wondered if anyone actually had used it. I'm just wondering about, you know, trailering, if this is going to be something to try in the water. I don't know. I just wondered
if salt is in there.
It's 18 to 22%.
Just salt?
It says salt.
Huh.
Well, it has the barley and the oats and the molasses, and it says 3% fat, 0.2% phosphorus, 0.15% calcium, and 6% fiber.
Huh.
Oh well.
Why don't you try it, and then in the next conference call, tell us how it went.
Okay, and it's made by Penfield.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting. Yep, I'll try it, and I'll let you all know.
Yeah, they're reputable. I mean, it might be tasty. I don't know.
Well, I'll try it, and we'll see if he likes it.
Nobody's ever used it in this crowd?
It doesn't sound like it.
Nope.
Okay, we've gotten through Cindy's aid. Allison didn't join us, is that correct? Stephanie, do you You have any additional questions?
No, actually, Cindy was right on when she was asking about where should she be doing the 100 and training, and then, you know, I wanted to know about the 50 mile before the 100. So those were my two burning questions for the night.
Okay. Let's see. I assume Cindy, you're not coming down to Leatherwood. That'd be a long.
No. No, I'm coming to Biltmore. That's the plan. So we'll see.
Okay, we will definitely look forward to seeing you there. Stephanie, are you coming to Leatherwood or?
No, the first ride I'm going to do is Chicken Chase.
Chicken Chase. Okay, we'll see you there.
What days are you riding Chicken Chase?
Pardon?
What days are you riding Chicken Chase?
We've entered the first two,
Friday and Saturday. Yeah.
Any other? Cindy, do you have any additional questions?
No, and I really appreciate the answers that you guys gave me. That was great. Thank you.
Okay, good. Well, I always learn from my everybody on the call.
Yeah, these are always fascinating.
These are always great. Let's see, is the next call, 4 weeks from now, Cheryl? Or?
I think we're talking closer to six. I want to actually, no, that won't work because that's Biltmore weekend.
No, don't do it Biltmore weekend.
It's like, wait a minute, no, can't do that. Let's try for the Monday before Biltmore, and that's going to be like the end of April, last Monday of April.
So does that work?
Does that work for people?
Yep. Yeah, that's April 28th.
I think that'll work.
Okay.
That works for me. I think, could we maybe spend a little more time on the, not so much night riding, but the getting sick part? Yeah. Because I think we've got some pukers in the crowd.
Is Troy still on the call? Is Troy on or did
yes, I'm on.
Did what advice?
I talked to my doctor last night.
Okay.
Night before she was over for dinner, and she said she thinks it's a combination. I was combining ibuprofen with some Celebrex, and either or of those can cause nausea in and of themselves if you're sensitive. And then she maintains that if you let yourself get dehydrated, you're going to be sensitive to nausea as well.
Yeah.
So her advice to me was to take naproxen, which is also the same as Aleve, 500 milligrams instead of a bunch of ibuprofen, and drink more fluids.
Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah, I think that's
try it.
Absolutely key is you've got to be so careful on a in a 50, you can get away without taking care of the rider yourself. But in 100, you can't. You've got to absolutely make sure you eat and drink properly.
And it was so cold. It got so cold there at Fitz. In that last loop, you know, I was sitting on my hands trying to keep them warm, and I certainly wasn't drinking enough the last loop for sure, and probably not on any of the previous loops either. It was a nice, cool day, and I mean, I would try to drink when I came into holds, but I wasn't drinking, you know, 12 ounces of fluid on a hold. You know, I was maybe drinking 6 ounces.
Yeah, I always try to overdrink after the first loop. I'm a little bit careful before the ride starts just because I like to not have to find a tree 5 miles into a ride, but after that, try to really overdrink.
One thing that is
helpful on cold rides, if you can do it, is have your crew have something hot for you at the checkpoint to really, you know, either hot chocolate or you know, something hot really sort of boost you and also make sure you are drinking. So if you can convince your crew to do that, it does wonders.
I have some food rules. Would you like to hear them?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, here's food rule. When anybody who I'm mentoring or is going to ride with me, I really hate watching people puke. So these are Dinah's food rules, and Steve's too, actually. You must eat at the first hold. It's not a choice. We don't care if you're hungry. It's not an issue. You will eat. You can pick what you're going to eat, but you must pick it the night before, and it must be enough. I mean, like, it's got to be at least a half a sandwich or something like that. An ear of corn. I don't care what it is. Yogurt, banana, whatever it is that you're going to eat. But you got to eat it. And you do have to eat it, and it doesn't matter how good or bad your horse is. You're going to eat it. The other thing is you must drink a complete bottle of water at the first hold. The whole thing, you know, the what are they, 12,
yeah.
15, whatever
that's
those things are.
Mm-hmm.
You must eat the whole thing, not part of it, not the 6 ounces, the whole damn bottle. And I don't care if you get off and pee. You won't. And after that, I don't care what you do.
I don't know about that.
After that, it doesn't matter what you do?
It does. But
oh.
You can eat at the first hold. It sort of keeps you going.
Right.
And you get more rational. But what happens is the same with the horses. They get irrational, and they don't take care of themselves at the beginning, and you never catch up.
Right.
And it's the same with the riders.
I will agree with that. There have been a couple rides I got off the 50s, just 50s, and I thought I was going to pass out. And it came down to the fact that I hadn't eaten adequately during the ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I like to do, I actually will do what Dinah said, except I do it with Gatorade. And one of the clear ones that doesn't have a lot of taste to it. Then I always carry, I like to carry a Camelback. Now, some people don't like it because of the way it feels, but I actually like particularly the smaller ones or something like a Camelback because you tend to drink more frequently because you're just sipping out of the nozzle. And I mix that on trail, half water and half Gatorade or water with some sort of sports electrolyte, you know, that an ultra marathoner would use or something like that at typically about half strength so that you keep your electrolyte, in addition to keeping your fluid up, you keep your electrolyte balance up.
Some of the other choices are, if you can stand it, is Pedialyte.
Right, that's what the doctor said.
Hmm. And it's not bad. Just don't get the unflavored one because that really does taste like sweat. you've got to be able to down it somehow. You know, you've got to be able to eat what you can eat. I mean, we all eat different things. But if you can follow the rule of drinking it every hold and setting your food out and really, especially in the first hundreds you do, committing to doing it because you're not going to want it.
No.
Truth is, you're not going to want it.
Yeah, and the other little trick.
And the other thing that you need to worry, ideally in your first hundreds especially, have crew so that if your horse in any way, shape, or form can be handed off safely to somebody else, you can take care of yourself, and you don't have to worry about your horse.
But if you have crew, assign somebody on the crew team, or make sure if you only have one crew that person is being a food czar and making sure you do eat. And the other trick I like to have is lots of different types of things there, because I never know what I'm going to like. But if I've got everything from herring to bananas to nectarines to, sandwiches to whatever, there's usually something that I'm willing to eat.
Herring?
Although I'm probably extreme. I usually am heavier at the end of 100 than I am later.
You eat herring?
Yes.
Yes, it's right up there with
filter fish.
Yeah.
Right up there with Steve's liverwurst. I mean,
right.
God, herring has all sorts of salt in it.
Had people ask to not be near us, I would think that would be true of you too, Stag.
I'm going to come over to your campsite. It's sort of like the horses, right?
Yeah.
They always like somebody else's food. I may come over.
We'll go steal snacks from each other.
Okay, well, maybe on that humorous note
that
reminds us that this is about fun also. We'll sign off and look forward to seeing you all at Biltmore and meeting you on the phone before then.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.